Evelyn, you've been doing some research on chronic wasting disease in the deer population. Could you tell me what you've been doing? What's your research?
Sure. I am part of a larger group who are actually trying to coordinate efforts between surveillance, genetics, and field studies on the movements of animals across the landscape in eastern Alberta where we have the disease. And this has been a concerted effort where we're trying to actually use the deer behavior as we learn it specifically for that area to predict the spread of the disease as it moves into Alberta. And the way we do that is we've put on a number of radio collars, including ones that used global positioning systems in the collar. That way we can track the animals in detail and look at the types of responses they have to the landscape. Now, one of our working hypotheses out there is that, in fact, the landscape patterns influence the contact rates among the different deer. So as the disease moves into the area, if they're clustered in certain areas because of the landscape patterns, then we expect the disease to spread very quickly. In other areas where they're more isolated, it may spread less quickly. And so this is one area of focus. The second area of focus is also looking at just the movement patterns themselves. When animals migrate, where do they go? North, south, east, west? Is there a general pattern? So if we find the disease in one area, can we then predict based on the migration or movement patterns whether it's going to show up in a different area? And if we can, a big question for us is what are those patterns on the landscape that are moving the animals in that direction? For example, one of our hypotheses right now is that the river drainages direct the movements of the animals. And because they're also good habitat, that along those river corridors, we're likely to see both a high prevalence of the disease and also the spread of the disease more quickly along those corridors. So some of my students who are working on this project are actually modeling the movements of deer. And then once they have developed those models, they will actually say, well, what if the disease was found here? They will use the models then to predict where it should turn up next. And then we can direct some of our surveillance studies to actually see if those pan out. If they do, then we think we have some predictive ability about where to anticipate the disease will move to.
You're putting radio collars on these deer. How do you get a radio collar on a deer?
Okay, well, we know how to do that over many years, and we've become quite proficient at it. We actually trap the deer two ways. The first one is we put out these, what's called a clover trap, and these are sturdy, metal-framed, but netting between the frames, and we bait them, and it has a trap door, so as the animal goes into the bait, it actually triggers the door catch, and it falls down. As it falls down, then the animal's trapped in the clover trap. It bounces around, but it's soft netting, so it gives, and the animals aren't hurt that way. Then we have graduate students and others that go in, and we wrestled them to the ground to some degree. It's very actually gentle, and we put a collar. We restrain them and put a collar on, and it all takes a very quick time. There's no drugs involved, so it's a very safe way to do it. There is a second way that we do it, and that way is what we call net gunning. And what happens there is with helicopters, we actually shoot a net over the animal. It trips the animals up, and then we actually can restrain the animal once it's in the net. And that also is a very quick and very efficient and not threatening to the animal way of capturing them. With that one, we can actually pick the individual animals. So for example, in our studies, we know from Wisconsin and Colorado where the disease has occurred that it occurs in males more often. So we've actually been able to put some of our GPS collars on males by being able to pick a male out and then shoot the net over them and then collar that particular animal.
Once you have the collars on and the GPS, what is it telling you? How far are these animals going?
Good question. It really depends on the animal. About 25 to 30% of the white-tailed deer and the mule deer in this area migrate during the winter to different areas, and then they come back in the summer to their summer ranges. The other about 70-75% of the animals stay in the same area year-round. So we're able to tell how much of the herd is actually migrating, and so how much are they mixing up with other animals from different areas. We're also able to then see how widely they move overall, whether they move more widely, say, during the rut, which is the breeding behavior time period of the year, and actually what kind of habitats that they use and where do they cluster, again, to look at the contact rates or potential contact rates between individuals.
Is there anything to indicate to you what the differences might be? Are there differences between how white-tailed deer and mule deer may behave or how they move, or even between younger and older deer, those kinds of things?
We're actually finding that in terms of the migration, or at least some of the larger movements that we expect to have new contact rates, the whitetails and the mule deer are doing fairly similar things. Now, we don't have our third year of data back. In fact, those collars will be retrieved sometime in March. And so as we're building the data, we may need more data for those particular patterns to emerge. But in terms of the migration, the proportion of the populations that migrate, it's about the same.
Now, you mentioned that you're finding that it's the males that tend to come down with the CWD rather than the females. Why is that?
That's a great question. We don't know the answer to that. We unfortunately don't know a lot about chronic wasting disease and how it's transmitted among animals. If we knew that, we could actually even design our studies better. But there are many people that are working on that in Wisconsin and Colorado. And hopefully over the next few years, better information will emerge. We don't think it's blood, but saliva or urine, feces, or at least what is the major route. We've not identified that at this point.
Well, if you look at the behavior of the animals then, if it is being transmitted through, say, saliva or feces, then how is it that it would get picked up by another animal?
Several ways. If it's through saliva, we have, for example, males that snort saliva on other males during the rutting season. They can put it on other vegetation, and animals will pick it up on the vegetation as they pass by it. There have been some interesting studies actually looking at scrapes, which are areas that they go and they kind of wallow in the soil. And so urine is passed there, and then other animals come along into those areas. So how it's passed, we don't know. We do think there's probably a individual-to-individual contact, but also an individual-to-environment-to-individual contact. And it really is that environmental contact that probably over the long run will be a major source of spread of the disease.
Now, you've indicated that you're not finished your research yet. What lies ahead?
Well, we're hoping by the end of, as I said, in March, we will get all of our collars back, so we'll have all of our data. At that point, we have some preliminary movement models to start making these predictions about where the disease should spread. We also have some models that we will feed that into to look at population level effects and maybe predict some alternative management scenarios that might be useful for controlling the disease. That way we can go to our partners, Alberta Fish and Wildlife, and say, well, here's some probabilities of decreasing, or if you don't do this, increasing the disease. And that's what's been our objective since day one, is try to help to manage the disease over time.
Do you have any preliminary suggestions of how things should be managed?
No, I really don't at this point. We do see some patterns of movement, and the one I alluded to earlier about these river drainages probably will be a significant point out of our results, but we haven't quantified that to the point where I'm willing to say it's any different than in any other area.
This is really just the beginning of an exploration of what chronic wasting disease is and what it means. What should be done to follow up on the research that you're doing?
That, again, is an excellent question. we don't know what the long-term effects of this disease are. And even our models are based on assumptions that we don't know hold true at this point. So I think we are learning through time, and one way we can do that is actually, because this is a slow disease to spread, we could set up some experiments based on different management scenarios and actually follow those through time. Now, that takes a lot of support from both the government and people, including the hunters out there, to participate. But if we're really going to understand this disease in the long term, I feel like that's the type of long-term monitoring combined with research that we ought to be doing.
Do you have anything to compare it to? I'm thinking of, well, say, the spread of brucellosis, for example, in cattle.
The environmental contamination puts this in a bit of a different light. It does stay in the environment for quite some time. And so the whole dynamic of the disease is probably driven by the individual contacts at the beginning, but in the long run, probably by the contamination in the soils and the picking up of the disease from the soils themselves. So it's a bit different that way and may persist in the environment much longer, making it a harder disease to deal with. But again, we don't know what the long-term effects will be. Perhaps, it is fatal, 100% fatal. So we've got to conclude at this point that it will have a major effect on the populations. But just how, over what time frame and how much is what we don't know at this point in time.
What effect does it have on the deer?
Well, it affects the neurological systems, and the animals lose their appetite. They basically waste away, as the name of the disease says. So they get thin, they're listless, their head droops down, their ears go down, and they basically become inactive, and they will eventually die. If you get the disease, it's 100% fatal. So it's not like at this point they will recover. There are no vaccines at this point. That's certainly something people are looking into and trying to understand the whole prion biology of the protein to be able to come up with vaccines and things like that. Unfortunately, in wildlife population, vaccines are also a very difficult management approach, but we don't even have that capability at this time.
I guess we wouldn't see them lined up the way people are to get their H1N1 vaccinations.
No, you're right.
Does it also affect the brain? Does the deer end up with a spongy brain the way a cow would?
Yes, it is a prion disease, and so being in the nervous system, it eventually takes hold of the brain and makes it like Swiss cheese, as you've heard about the spongiform brain, and you can actually see those lesions in the brain. And that's really the gold standard of looking at the brain stem.
And if you're just walking through the woods and you see an animal, like, can you tell just by looking at it if it has this disease?
You can suspect the disease, but you can't be sure unless you actually test for it. The behaviors can come from other poor nutrition. Usually the combination, you can probably take a good guess, but really you don't know until you test for the disease that that's the cause of death or even the loss of weight and things like that, and appetite and things like that.
What percentage of the population do you think has it at this point?
Right now, my understanding, there are only about 54 cases in Alberta at this point. So it's a very low percentage at this point.
Thank you very much, Evelyn.
You're welcome.